And so that's the story on that. You asked something else with that question. What was the other thing you said, Sam?
Yes, you're really good. You asked everything. But how do you avoid running into a meteor or a comet?
Oh, yeah, well, there are far and few between. You know, it's you know, comets, you know, are very rare. And they should not come in too close to Earth. I think the closest one we've ever had was not Halley's, but Hale Bob came pretty close. And that was like many times the distance away from the Earth is the Moon. So their idea of close is, you know, millions of miles away. The chances of hitting a comet are probably like, you know, one in a billion. And, you know, if there was something coming, let's say they're in orbit, like the space station, Cheyenne, Mountain, and NORAD, they track hundreds of thousands of things that are in orbit. And if they see something coming along in orbit that's coming within, you know, could go within a couple of miles of the International Space Station, they'll let the space station computers know and astronauts know that it's, you know, it's time to move, and they'll ignite their jets. They have jets in the service module of the Russian side. Little thrusters are going to come on, and it'll push them a little faster, where the next time they come around in orbit, this piece that will probably be there within a couple of hours won't be within that mile and a half. I think that's the limit that they require, a mile and a half location. You know, if it's outside of that, they don't worry about it. And then let's say they did put the thrusters on, and it just wasn't right, and it's still coming within that mile and a half on that second orbit. That's why they do it the first time. The second orbit around, an hour and a half later, mission control will look at it and say, well, you know, we need one more thrust. The engines would ignite again, and it would move forward and make sure they're further away from, you know, some kind of space junk. But, yeah, they track all this junk that's up there. Anything that's 10 centimeters or larger, they can see on radar. That's 4 inches. Anything 4 inches or larger. Anything smaller than that, they have to worry about. There's like 100,000 pieces of junk that are flying around that it's not all in the same orbit of the space station, of course. You know, collectively around the Earth. So who knows? You know, they don't have that much stuff flying around in the orbit of the space station. But it's a problem, and they try to deal with it. But I don't think it keeps them up at night. You know, they're up there for, you know, 6 months at a time, and sometimes longer. Like Scott Kelly was up there for almost a year. So was Christopher Koch. She was up there for almost a year. I don't think they're losing any sleep over this. Back to you, Sam. WS2N.
Well, I sure lost sleep. I just see, like, we here on a real highway, maybe in Arizona, you can drive fast, no other cars. But you got the Russians, got spaceship China, and to avoid running into each other is amazing. Like when you mention the word radar, then now I know. Because if you can see them, you can't really see, but you can see the radar, and you know where they are. Thank you so much, 82NSJ.
Very good, KD2NSJ, WS1. And, And that's a more and more popular topic nowadays. There are companies involved in trying to figure out how to get rid of the debris that's up there. They have companies like Northrop Grumman docking with existing spacecraft that are running out of fuel that would will eventually become space junk, but now they, you know, they're giving these billion-dollar spacecraft are an extension of life by connecting to them and using the fuel from their own spacecraft to maneuver to a different location and keeping the spacecraft up there maybe 5 years longer before it became junk. So missions like that are now active. They've done two of them so far. You have companies developing different exotic ways of trying to catch all the space junk that's up there. And I'm sure it's going to be more popular as the years go on. The European Space Agency in Japan are very active in doing that. Anyway, I just wanted to mention the Rosalind Franklin ExoMars rover. NASA got JPL involved with the European Space Agency, helping them out. The Rosalind Franklin rover was supposed to launch with all these other rockets that went to Mars last July. That rover missed its window. It was actually going to be launched on a Russian rocket. They were paying Russia to launch it. But the parachute, they were having problems when they were running the parachute test. So they missed their window. They didn't have enough time to make the change designs that they needed to do. So they got Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Of course, they're great with all these parachutes. We've launched many vehicles that have landed on Mars, five different rovers, probably a half a dozen different landers, you know, two Viking missions. And it's still active. There was another one that landed on the north, close to the North Pole on Mars. So they have good experience with the parachutes. And I read that they're coming a long way with that. So it looks like they'll probably be ready for the next window to fly to Mars, which would be 2022. Then that should be good. Their next step for this 100-foot parachute that they're going to be opening up, I think it's 35 meters, but yeah, it's a big parachute. And definitely 35 meters in diameter. They have drogue chutes that are going to pull it out, and one parachute is supposed to open up, and it'll eventually land the European Space Agency's rover on Mars in a couple of years from now. But to test this parachute further, they're going to put it on this high altitude balloon and send it up 18 miles. And once it's up about 18 miles, which is way up, you know, a plane flies like, 6 miles high or something. This thing's going up three times that height. They'll release it, and it'll be a similar atmosphere speed of what they need to achieve when it's actually going to land on Mars at that altitude. And they're going to test that soon. It looks like, from what I read, that it will probably be successful. If that's successful, they'll put it all together. And I'm sure they'll repack and re-engineer everything they can for that Mars lander. By the way, that one's solar powered as well. Oh, I know a question that Sam asked. Here I am going way late, but he asked about the different fuels that they use. Let me get to that. All the different rockets. This WS2M. When they launch from Earth, the most common fuel that everybody uses right now is called RP-1, or Rocket Propellant 1. All it really is a kerosene, very similar kerosene that they put on jet planes, but it's a refined kerosene. It goes through all kinds of filtering, but essentially it's jet fuel that has been cleaned up a bit. And That's the most common fuel. They use it on the Falcon 9 rocket that SpaceX uses. Russia is using it on the Soyuz rocket. But then another common fuel that's used is liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. The space shuttle, a big tank that used to see it, used to separate from the shuttle. External tank had, you know, liquid hydrogen in it and liquid oxygen. So that's what that used when you saw a lot of that smoke coming out of those three engines on the space shuttle. That was essentially water vapor, hydrogen mixed with oxygen after going through the ignition combustion procedure through the RS-25 engines. So that, again, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, also used on the European Space Agency's Ariane 5 rocket. They have a big rocket, big tank. You can see that as well. They use the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Now, both the shuttle and Ariane 5 also use solid booster rockets. That's aluminum oxide type of material that's been packed inside these big solid booster rockets. So, like, when they ignite, there's no control in the speed of the stuff. They ignite, that's it. You're going for a ride. You can't shut them down. You can't control them, but, you know, it's essentially a skyrocket. Where once those are separated from either the Ariane 5 rocket and the European Space Agency or the shuttles, then the liquid engines take over. Now, those are very versatile. That you could, you know, raise the thrust on them. You could lower the thrust on them. In some cases, you could shut it off, reignite them, depending on what engines we're talking about. So they're the most common ones. Now, the newest ones that are going to be used in quite a few vehicles are liquid methane fuels. Liquid methane is being used by SpaceX. SpaceX uses Falcon 9 with the RP-1, but yet their new Starship that they're building down in Boca Chica, Texas, that's using liquid methane and liquid oxygen. Another company that's going to be using it is Boeing and Lockheed, called the United Launch Alliance. They launched the Atlas V rocket, again, that's launched with RP-1, refined kerosene. But they have a new rocket they're developing, and it's called the Vulcan rocket, which is going to they're going to phase out the Atlas V rocket. So the Vulcan rocket that's being developed is, again, liquid methane with liquid oxygen. So that's becoming a popular fuel. Another one that's going to be using it will be the New Glenn rocket by Blue Origin. They're building it in a factory in Florida, right near Launch Complex 36, where they'll launch that thing. And that thing's almost as big as the Saturn V, too. That's a big rocket, New Glenn. And I expect that to go up probably sometime late next year. And again, that's liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So a lot of different types. They are main ones. You have your newest ones that once you're in space, if you want a spacecraft to travel for long distances, they have their ion rockets now. You know, sounds like something out of Star Trek, but that's what they have, ion rockets, which are very, very good, which you can use. The amount of weight of fuel that you use is hardly anything to get a rocket going. It's super, super fast. The only difference is the engines, like, never shut off. The Dawn spacecraft that went to two different asteroids, Ceres and Vesta. First went to Vesta and then went to Ceres. Actually orbited Vesta and then deorbited and then orbited Ceres. To do that with a chemical rocket, you'd have to have a million different gas tanks up there to refuel it. But with the ion rockets, they ignite them. They lit for years. And not much thrust, but over time, next thing you know, you really get up to speed. So that's the story on the different fuels. I know Sam asked me that. I forgot to answer. Anyway, it's getting late. Look at the time. I'll say 73, tomorrow night we'll have the club net. They call it the info net, the club info net, on these repeaters at 8:30, not 8 o'clock. This net comes on at 8, but club net comes on at 8:30. You don't have to be a member to check in, but it's always good to hear what the club is doing. I'm going to turn it back over to Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the Space Net Report. And for the TACNET, by the way, if anybody wants to email me, instead of going through Roy, Roy's got his hands full, but you can go through both. My email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report and all that you do. And thanks to Andy, WA2CDL, for Andy's Corner. And I look forward to the next edition in weeks to come. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a technical net by your participation, so I really, really do appreciate coming and bringing that participation to it. Want to remind people just one quick time, once again, you want to email me, the address is mailbag@ac2gs. You want to take a look at some interesting articles that I've collected on my link page, you can get there by typing into the browser roy.ac2gs.com. I stream W2VL once again, try and do it about 24/7, so if you will want to get it on a browser for whatever reason, it should be available. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and you'll have an internet stream of the repeater. And as always, want to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of the technical nets that go back to September of 2006 with a lot of wisdom from many, many amateur radio operators who have gone on to be unfortunately silent keys, but their advice remains very valuable, and please avail yourself of Mike's archives. They're available at amateurradio.tv. And as Dick K2RIW often ended his TechNet, please be kind to each other. In these times, more than any other, it's important. So be kind to each other, be well, be safe, be smart. And if you can, be back here next Sunday night. I realize it's Memorial Day weekend and other people have other plans, but please try and make it here, and let's see if we can do this all over again next Sunday. And thankfully, my 150 watts of power were able to get to this small little temporary repeater antenna. So, but I thank Lou for setting up the UHF link just in case it failed. So this is AC2GS officially closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. Be safe and have a great week, and we'll be back to do it again next Sunday. This is AC2GS going clear.